One of the most exciting topics in astronomy research at the moment is galaxy formation and evolution. Now, just following the first session on the topic, I caught up with Professor Richard Ellis from the University of Oxford to tell us a little bit more.
We heard a little bit about cosmic downsizing today. Can you explain a little bit what we mean by cosmic downsizing?
Yes,
we've heard
about
downsizing in the job market or in a company.
It's a similar thing. We used to think that galaxies grew from small things, getting bigger, like Lego, building bigger and bigger things as time goes on, that the very first galaxies will be quite small, and then they would merge. Gravity is an attractive force. It brings galaxies together. And so we'd have a large number of little things, and then they would merge and produce a smaller number of big things. And if this was correct, then the latest galaxies to form would be the biggest ones, and they would have formed most recently. Mm. Then astronomers in the 90s found that this wasn't the case, in fact, that we found that quite a long time ago there were lots of big galaxies in place. And in fact, they've stopped growing, whereas little galaxies are continuing to grow. And so this seemed the opposite of what we expected. And as often happens in science, you know, there was one camp, in this case the observers, pointing out their data and saying something's wrong here. Look at the data. Hmm. And the theorists were saying, oh, no, we don't believe this.
And how could we be wrong?
How could we be wrong? And so the phrase downsizing got coined. It was first introduced by Len Cowie, an astronomer in Hawaii. And he said, you know, look at this. The galaxies at high redshift are already there, and there are big ones. And as we go, as time progresses, most of the action switches to lower mass galaxies. So what's going on? Well, firstly, the result is correct. The observers were right, and the theorists have had to regroup and, you know, eat a bit of humble pie in the process. And now what we think is going on is that there are additional processes that govern how a galaxy grows. Firstly, we have to admit that some galaxies did collapse very quickly when the universe was young and form quite massive systems. And this is permitted within the dark matter picture of the universe. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with that idea. But when a galaxy gets to a certain size, it shuts itself off. And the name of the game now is to try to find what is the process by which a galaxy understands that it can no longer accept any more material. Mm-hmm. Well, what does a galaxy accrete? It accretes gas, hydrogen gas. And in order for that gas to form stars, the gas has to cool. So if you can find an engine inside a galaxy that keeps the gas hot, it will never cool, and it will never form any stars. And we now think that the mechanism that prevents a galaxy from going beyond a certain size is, lo and behold, the black hole in the middle. Now, black holes have, of course, been familiar in astronomy for decades, but it's only quite recently that we realized that they're in pretty well every big galaxy. Mm. And now there's a very tight correlation between the mass of the black hole and the size of the galaxy in which it sits. So it's pretty obvious that the black hole is governing the galaxy in some way. And now we're looking for what is the means by which the black hole in the center of the galaxy tells the whole galaxy stop growing. Well, we think it's that there's a jet of activity which heats up incoming gas, either blows it away or heats it so that it can't cool and form any more stars. And this is what we call feedback, very similar to feedback in an electrical circuit that, you know, goes round and round and stops a galaxy from growing anymore.
This process of you have a galaxy with lots of gas being pulled into the black hole, it gets blown out in a massive jet. And that in turn turns off
the rest of the star formation. Mm. And so the galaxy then becomes a red galaxy, very old, doesn't have any more activity. And then as the universe expands, lower mass galaxies don't have such a powerful black hole, and so the feedback circuit isn't working there, so they keep growing and they keep forming stars. And so it's the black hole to the rescue. That is the agent of downsizing.
Hmm. And these galaxies which are showing this feedback activity currently, they form a special class of galaxies, don't they? A special type?
Yes. So the galaxies that are active at the moment are a subset of the overall population. And now what's key, the key question that we're addressing here at the meeting in Belfast is the demographics. Take the population. How many galaxies are being shut off? how many galaxies are close to being shut off, how many galaxies are having a whale of a time forming lots of stars. And obviously the numbers that you see in a snapshot of time, because of course, you know, we don't live long enough to see any evolution in the universe, significantly. The number that you see on the sky is of course a record of how long it takes for each phase to act. And so there's a lot of activity here at the meeting in trying to understand, you know, whether we have the right picture now. But I think we're on the right track.
Exciting stuff.
Yeah, it is. It's and, you know, black holes have long been a thorn in our side. We didn't know where they fitted in. We knew every galaxy probably had one, but we didn't know what role they played. And now we see they're central to this cosmic downsizing.
It's remarkable, isn't it? Because although we know that the black holes in the center of galaxies are so-called supermassive black holes, they are very,
right,
very large.
Right.
And certainly they influence the galaxy using their gravity. However, it's not directly the gravitational pull of the supermassive black hole which is doing this feedback mechanism.
No. What we're learning is that there's forces other than gravity governing the history of galaxies. The mistake that the theorists and all of us made in the 80s and early 90s was thinking that gravity is really the force that brings together galaxies and makes them grow. It's certainly true that gravity is the dominant force in the universe that brings things together, but it doesn't explain everything that we understand about, for instance, galaxies that look like ellipticals, galaxies that have spiral structure like our own Milky Way. We now realize that there are other forces related to the growth of black holes and the influence that these jets have on heating the gas and preventing or inhibiting further star formation. So it's what we're really doing is maturing the subject. We're moving into a more realistic view of how the universe evolved.
It's a more complicated view, but we think we're getting a handle on it.
And I think the main lesson from all this is don't ignore the observers. You know, we were right. There is a problem, and now we've made progress in solving it, heading that way.
We have to explain reality, not just make it up, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. Observations are key.
Are there any other feedback mechanisms that are important in galaxy formation?
Yes. So very early on, when the universe is quite young, and the very first feeble galaxies form, so we're now talking about very low-mass objects that really are not anywhere near the size of our Milky Way. Maybe if you know what a globular cluster is, it's a ball of stars that typically are about 1 million to 10 million times the mass of the Sun. Well, the very first galaxies that are collapsing when the universe is very young, 5% of its present age, are about 100 million times the mass of the Sun. These galaxies are very frail. If a star forms, a massive star forms in these galaxies and eventually explodes as a supernova, the energetics of that supernova can be sufficiently powerful that it can just throw all the gas that's in that galaxy out of the galaxy, snuffing that galaxy completely. Mm. So, you know, poor thing, it's forming when the universe is very young, yes, has a huge explosion, snuffs it out, and it just dies. Mm. And this is what we call supernova feedback, and it can be very effective in the early universe in deciding which galaxies survive and which galaxies don't. What happens to these failed objects, we don't know. But it's quite likely that there are many more little things out there that, you know, just had one burst of activity and then just died. And there's been a problem in astronomy for some time that if one looks around the Milky Way and the Andromeda spiral, although we see a lot of low-mass galaxies, we call them dwarf galaxies, we don't quite see the number that theory would predict, the dark matter theory, that is. Mm. And one explanation for this might be that many of them just, you know, snuffed out very early on when the universe was quite young.
Yeah.
So there's another form of feedback.
The whole topic of star formation history, can you explain a little bit more about what we mean by star formation history?
Yeah, so what we're trying to determine with the star formation history, of course, is we're using our telescopes as time machines to try to understand when did the bulk of the stars in the universe, in the Milky Way, if you like, when did they form? We have a lot of stars around us today, but how old are they? Well, of course, with our big telescopes, using them as time machines, we can slice the universe in history and see how much star formation is going on at any particular remote point in the past. And then we do this successively at different distances, or hence look-back times, and we can piece together when most of the stars in the universe switched on. And what we find is that there's a magic period around a redshift of 2, so that's about 10 billion years ago, when the activity peaked. That is when, you know, if you like, it's the sort of teenage era, you know, when everything happens in a galaxy. And obviously then, once we know that, then, of course, a lot of attention focuses on that period in cosmic history. You know, what's going on? Which are the agents? Which galaxies are growing? You know, what is the process?
Why then did everything just became so exciting? I guess that's the question. Why?
Well, we have a... It's not... You know, it is a good question. Why then and not later or earlier? I mean, the answer, as with so many things, is it's a toss-up between, firstly, you've got to have enough time for the universe to develop hydrogen and then form big clouds of gas, and then, you know, the conditions have to be right enough for those gas clouds to cool and form stars. So some of the answers to that question of when really relates to physical processes. How long does it take a hydrogen cloud to collapse? How long does it take, you know, stars to form and so forth? Basically, I think the cosmic star formation history, or that is the history of how star formation developed, is one of the triumphs of the last, say, 5 years, that we've got various ways of measuring how stars... the star formation rate. For instance, we can use ultraviolet light that's very sensitive to young stars. Stars that are very young are very hot and they emit copiously at ultraviolet wavelengths. So satellites like GALAX, an ultraviolet satellite launched in America, has been very effective at doing that. But also, substar formation is obscured. It's seen obscured in dust clouds. Now, if you have a hot star embedded in a dust cloud, it heats up that dust, and that dust eventually glows at a much cooler temperature, a few tens of degrees Kelvin, but it will eventually escape as a black body radiation in the infrared. And Spitzer Space Telescope has been very successful in tracing the obscured star formation. So we've learned a lot of lessons over the last 10 years. Firstly, we were doing the star formation history business largely using optical and ultraviolet diagnostics, but it seems that we were missing a lot of the activity, which now the Spitzer Space Telescope has complemented. So piecing together it all, I think we now have a pretty good understanding of when most of the stars in the universe formed.
It's these infrared observations which, as you say, complement the optical observations. They don't necessarily supersede them or contradict the results.
It's it's interesting, just sociologically, when the subject first developed, you know, the optical astronomers thought they had the whole scene covered, and then the infrared astronomers came along and said, you're missing all this activity. And so there's a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing with one side thinking the other was superior and so forth. Now we realize you need both, and they complement each other very well. Mm. So as often happens, and I think that's one thing that we've seen at this meeting, that astronomers are much more panchromatic. They're no longer cast into these partitions of, you know, I don't consider myself an optical astronomer, I do infrared work as well. Mm. And the younger generation, which are here in abundance at the Belfast meeting, are extremely panchromatic. They'll use any facility. And that's just a delight to see. And that's really probably the biggest change in the subject over the last 10 years, is astronomers, the observers, are multi-wavelength.
Wonderful. One last thing before I let you go and get your lunch.
Right.
Give us a minute or two on how you got into astronomy.
Ah, okay. So I was brought up in Wales, and there was a public library, and I went into the public library and I picked up a little book called Into Outer Space by Patrick Moore. It's a little blue book. It was a story about two children who went to visit their uncle, who was an astronomer, a fictional story. And I read this book, and it was really quite inspirational. I was 6 at the time, and I decided at that point I wanted to devour every book on astronomy in the public library. And years later, maybe 45 years later, I went on Patrick Moore's Sky at Night program, and I told him this story about this little book. And lo and behold, he found an old copy. I think it was his personal copy, and he signed it and sent it to me. So I have this book, and I read it, you know, 45 years later, and I remembered the chapters. I couldn't
believe
it.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so it had a happy ending.
Thank you very, very much indeed.
Pleasure.
For taking the time to talk to us. We do appreciate it very, very much indeed.
Good.